Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is David Sedaris, the author and humorist whose latest collection of essays, Calypso, is now available in paperback from the good folks at Little Brown & Company. In addition to his books, David's writing has appeared regularly in The New Yorker, and you can catch him from time to time on both the CBS Sunday Morning television program and National Public Radio. David, I've always described and thought of your books as a collection of personal essays. The publisher calls them stories. Is that a distinction without a difference?
Oh, gosh, I didn't notice what they called them. I think they don't like to say essay because it sounds boring. But I think of them as personal essays.
Well, in this particular collection...
I guess when I'm writing them, I mean, I think of shaping them as a story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, like having them move along the way that a story would. But, technically they're personal essays.
Well, in this particular collection, many of them are set in your beach house on the Carolina coast, which you named it C-section. And I didn't realize people named beach houses like that. But as an American who's been living in Europe, what point had you arrived at in your life when you decided it was time to buy a beach house in the States?
Well, in eastern North Carolina, the beach houses have names. And they're usually like pun names. They used to be pun names, right? Like Dunar Thing and Crabadabadoo, things like that. And a lot of the new houses have names like God's Place, which... I don't know where that comes from. But I bought the place on the coast of North Carolina because, I don't know, my mother always really wanted a house there, and we would go there on vacation when we were children. And every year my father would say, wouldn't it be great to have a house down here? And then he'd set up appointments with real estate agents. And we'd look at houses all week, and my mother would get so excited. And then every single time, my father would say, well, financially, it just doesn't make that much sense. And then everyone would be devastated. So I just decided I would be the one to buy it. So I bought it, and then it got destroyed by a hurricane last year.
Well, a great deal of this collection of stories addresses your view that the clock is running out as you're now in your 60s. Do you remember the moment in your life when you began to shoot past your immediate future for your thoughts toward your own mortality?
I think it was when people started calling me sir. So it wasn't really that long ago, but one day I would drop something and somebody would say, hey, buddy, you dropped your ticket. And then the next day it was, excuse me, sir, you know, like, in a loud voice, like I'm deaf as well. You dropped your ticket. So, and it didn't happen to, it happened, you know, really kind of on schedule, you know, when I turned 60. I'm 62 now.
And then even giving up seats, you've written about this, giving up the seat on the bus to you, right?
Yeah, God gave me his seat. I was in New York City a few weeks ago on the subway, and a guy who looked like he was going to audition for the role of Mugger stood up and gave me his seat on the subway. I didn't even have a bag in my hand. I was just, it's not like I was carrying anything or I was on crutches or anything. I just stepped on the subway, and he jumped up the way you might if, like, Methuselah got onto the subway.
Does that offend you?
You know, it's weird because on the one hand, it's infuriating, and on the other hand, you really want the seat. So it's a fair trade-off, I suppose.
You mentioned growing up in Carolina, and you moved to the South. You were a youngster. And in the book, I found it very interesting. You revealed an incident in 1968 when you were at a restaurant with your family, and it really opened your eyes. What happened?
My parents were at a restaurant called the 42nd Street Oyster Bar in Raleigh, North Carolina, and a cook came out of the kitchen and announced that Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot, and everybody stood up and cheered. And it was, we had just moved to North Carolina, and so, I mean, my parents were at the restaurant, we weren't there, and they came home and told us about it. And it was just such a, I remember even as a child thinking like, well, gosh, that's not very nice.
Did your parents see it the same way?
Well, they just felt, I mean, it's interesting. I'm not one of those people. I don't feel the need to be around people who think exactly the way that I do. You know, I kind of find it healthier not to be around people who agree with me on everything. But every now and then something will happen, and then you think, gosh, I really am kind of alone here, you know? And I think that was one of those moments for my parents when they just felt like kind of alone. Because they were the only ones who didn't stand up and applaud.
There's six Sedaris kids among you. One of them is deceased, and now you're five, as you say in the book. I thought about, as I read about the interactions between you and your siblings, I think about when I golf. I usually have three or four great shots during a round, and I think to myself, this is what keeps me coming back. And you write the same thing about your relationship with your siblings. But has that relationship with your siblings matured in direct proportion to your own personal maturity?
I mean, we were always close. You know, it changes. I mean, it's funny how often people will ask me who's my favorite sibling, and I answer, you know, probably the way a parent might, you know, and I say that I don't have one. I don't have a favorite, but the relationships change over time. You know, maybe you're best friends with one brother or sister for a couple of years, and then you become best friends with another one. And, I mean, I think it's, what's interesting is that, you know, like I said, I'm 62, and I have a sister who's older than me, and my youngest brother is 51, and we're still all somebody's child. You know, in the days of yore, your parents would die when they were like 65, you know. And our father's 96. And so we're still somebody's children. And often, you know, I know when my mother died, it changed a lot just because in my family, you tended to belong to either one parent or the other, you know.
Sure.
And I belonged to my mother, and so when she died, I had to kind of, my relationship with my father changed a bit, and my relationship with my siblings changed a bit. And so I imagine the same will happen when my father dies.
Is your father sort of the glue that holds everything together at this point, or are there different spots where there's glue between the five of you remaining?
I'm the glue. Yeah, I'm the glue. My father is just, he just moved into an assisted living place. Mm-hmm. But he's still, you know, quick. I mean, there's nothing wrong with his memory or there's nothing wrong with his mind. I mean, he's 96, and he called my older sister on the telephone last week. The one who's been driving, you know, 200 miles to take him to doctor's appointments. And so he phoned her to tell her that she was a loser who hasn't done anything with her life. That's the kind of old man he is.
Well, I'm chatting with David Sedaris, whose new latest collection of essays, Calypso, is available now in paperback from Little Brown and Company. David, when you write about your family, you will add your own humorous quips, but it seems when the subject matter turns darker, when you discuss your sister's suicide, for example, it's almost as if you take your voice out and you let the narrative speak for itself, almost in a journalistic fashion, but nonetheless engaging. Is that a conscious technique?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, it was hard finding the tone to write about my sister's suicide. I know that certain people, not people that are in my family, but certain people were, you know, they thought the tone was too light, you know, for that essay. But I don't want to get up in front of an audience and not get laughs, you know. And in the wake of my sister's suicide, there was a lot of laughter. I mean, my family got together, and there was a lot of laughter. I mean, there always is. And I found that really heartening, you know, that there was, in the wake of this tragedy, there were still things to laugh about. And I wanted to include that in the essay, because to me, that essay was about my family in the aftermath of my sister's suicide. You know, it wasn't about her suicide as much as it was how we were living in its wake.
You talked about being in front of an audience, and take me back to the times when you were washing windows, doing all these odd jobs. You're in a club in New York, and Ira Glass discovers you. That's got to be a time when you think this could go somewhere, or it could go nowhere.
Well, actually, I was living in Chicago at the time, and Ira was living in Chicago as well. And I was just doing a reading with, you know, I wasn't the only one. There were a number of people on the bill. And at that time, Ira was reporting on school system for National Public Radio. So I knew his name, right, from the radio. And then he introduced himself because we, you know, knew somebody in common. And then that was it. We just shook hands, and that was it. It never occurred to me that anything, I didn't expect him to do anything for me. It never occurred to me. And then I moved to New York City, and then he called a few years later and asked if I had anything Christmassy that would work for a local show he had on in Chicago at the time called The Wild Room, which was sort of an early version of This American Life. So I recorded, I'd worked as an elf at Macy's, and so I recorded a series of diary entries from the time that I worked there, and then he put it on his show, and then he put it on Morning Edition, and that sort of changed a lot for me. Well, it changed everything for me.
And they still play the Sandaland Diaries every December on NPR, right?
I guess so. I mean, you couldn't pay me to listen to it, but... I'm aware of it.
Well, you were on CBS Sunday Morning a couple weeks ago talking about movie casting and using a completely abled person to play the role of an amputee and have his legs removed in post-production, and you extrapolated that into when they cast a straight man to play a gay man. When those appearances come about, do they give you a topic and say go, or do you tell them I have something and they just put you on?
Well, they invited me to be a contributor, and the only rule... There's a time rule. I think it has to be 2.5 minutes. And it can't be overtly political, right? So you can't, let's say, you know, they don't want you to talk about Mitch McConnell or, you know, anybody in the administration or, you know, they don't. But it can be, I mean, I felt like what I wrote about is kind of political in nature, but it's not overtly. And that's the only rule. And they didn't, I recorded 4 of them so far, and they didn't edit any of them. They didn't, I presented them. I figured they would, if something was inappropriate or something, they would turn it down, but they didn't. And it's actually a good little assignment. And it's something I don't know that I could have done. 20 years ago, I did a little program similar that was for the BBC. Called Live from New York, and I had did commentaries for that. It was only an eight-week series, and I looked back at some of those commentaries that I did, and I just wasn't really kind of skilled enough to pull it off, I don't think, because it's tough, 2.5 minute time slot, you know, especially if you've got a lot to say. But I really welcome that challenge now, and I'm constantly thinking of other issues that I could write about. And the one I did about kind of representation, I guess you would call it, you know, I said at the beginning, I don't know where I come down on it, and I still don't know where I come, you know, I'm not insisting that, you know, I think once you go down that road and you say, okay, only, you know, only gay people are allowed to portray gay people, then where does that end? You know, could only Catholics be Catholics? So I don't know where I come down on it. It was kind of amusing on the whole thing, I suppose.
Well, it at least starts a conversation, right?
But you know what bothers me more than anything else is when you see a movie and somebody's smoking and they're not a real smoker, and you can just tell they're not a real smoker. And I heard an interview with Allison Janney, the actress, mm-hmm. and I guess she's a heavy smoker. And she's often brought in to consult people on how to properly smoke in a movie. And I listened to an interview she did, and she said, real smokers never look at their cigarette. You know, when you watch a movie and you think, oh, that person doesn't know how to smoke, they're always like kind of gazing lovingly at their cigarette. But if you're an actual smoker, you don't even look at it when you light it. And I thought, oh, that was a really good observation.
Well, I've smoked,
I
know that.
I quit smoking 10 years ago, but... If you handed me a cigarette right now, I don't definitely know how to smoke it. I mean, I wouldn't need any practice to get back into it.
Well, yeah, when you're smoking, it's just second nature. You don't even think about it.
Right.
So have you become more cynical as you've aged?
More cynical? I think I've become less cynical as I've aged, actually.
Why?
I've never really thought of myself as a cynic, but maybe I'm not the best judge of that. But I think I've become less.
Your sister.
Less cynical.
Your sister Amy told the New York Times back in 1993 that you would never consider yourself a writer, even though you've been writing since your teenage years. But all these books later, is that still true?
Well, I would never have called myself a writer. I think because I, you know what. There are just certain things that I feel like you should wait until the world calls you. Like, when I went to art school, I remember the teacher had us go around the room and talk about identify ourselves. And I remember this guy saying, my name is John, and I'm an artist, and I just cringed for him. It just seems, you know, where when it came my turn, I said, my name is David, and I paint sometimes, right? That was what I said. But... So I always hesitated to call myself a writer. I just felt like the world should call me one. And then, it wasn't really until I started writing for The New Yorker. And then I thought, okay, well, if you write for The New Yorker, I'm pretty sure you can confidently identify yourself at a cocktail party as a writer. You know, but before that, if I was traveling, you know, to Europe, I would have to fill out these forms and they would ask for my occupation. And then I would just put typist. But I should have, put bad typist, because after all these years, I just type with one finger.
And then misspell typist.
The sorriest typist in the world.
You know, you're on these tours all the time. They always take you through Omaha, it seems. What is it about the Omaha audience and the bookworm that keep you coming back?
Well, I have a dear friend in Omaha, and... So it's always great to go and see her. But I remember for the first time I went there, I'd never been in Nebraska before, and I just saw that big building that said Woodsman. So I was just surprised when I went to the theater and there were people there. You know, whenever you go to a place you've never been and an audience shows up, you always think, what on earth are you doing here? You know, I mean, you're flattered that they came, but at the same time, you're wondering, what brought you here? And the Bookworm's just a great little independent bookstore, and they've just always been so kind to me. And so I just like spending time there.
All right. Well, the book is Calypso. It's David Sedaris' latest collection of personal essays, stories. It's available now in paperback, wherever your fine books are sold, including The Bookworm in Omaha. David, just fantastic talking to you about this book. Hope you enjoy the rest of your tour, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.